And now WDEV FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us this morning. I'm doing something different than I typically do on a Friday at the State House. I have jam-packed the first part of today's program, but left open the last 30 minutes for your phone call. I have a stack of things I haven't gotten to in the week, but because we've been talking politics mostly the last few weeks, if there's something else on your mind and you would like, I'd like to hear from you about it. Perhaps a movie recommendation or town meeting concerns. It will be a chance to cover a topic that's important to you. That's in the last 30 minutes of the program. We'll start in the first hour by having a conversation with Jason Rowe. He's a senior advisor and strategist to the Marco Rubio campaign, and then State Senator Peg Flory, who's the chair of the Senate Institutions Committee. We'll not only talk about state issues dealing with the Capitol bill, which is the construction bill in the Institutions Committee, IT issues, and IT issues have been issues with the state, but also she's supporting Governor John Kasich, and we'll talk about that. And also coming on the show this morning will be Dick Mazza. He's a Democrat from Colchester. The governor's office was very, very critical of him, and that is surprising because he has been an ally of the governor. The governor called him a Republican, and the governor's spokesman called him a Republican. One of the things that you, I guess, in politics is, where's the loyalty? I mean, Senator Dick Mazza has had the governor's back in many occasions, and now his spokesman calls him a Republican. He's been, you know, here's the question I think I'll ask Senator Mazza is, how long have you been a Democrat? And I suspect it's going to be multiple decades. And then I'm going to ask, the governor's spokesperson is Scott Coryell, how old is he? And I bet the answer is much younger than how long Dick Mazza has been a Democrat. So Interesting tactic that the governor's office, actually, he called two Democrats, Bobby Starr and Dick Mazza, Republicans. I don't know why the governor's office is picking this fight. And as I said, in the second hour, we'll open up the phone lines for your phone calls. But I just wanted to check in with WDEV in Waterbury and see if our first guest is on the line, because I'm remote at the State House and I can't tell. Okay, what we'll know, there hasn't been, let's go to some of the things that we would go to in the second hour of this program. And I have a stack of material that I normally just leave for the weekend, but if I've got some time here, what I'd like to do is go through this stack. And one of the things that I saw today, actually, in Vermont Digger was ideas to make Vermont more affordable for young people. And this was written by Scott McKay, who lives in Waterbury and is the managing partner at KSE Partners. That's a governmental affairs firm, a lobbying firm here in Montpelier. And some of the things I thought you would find were somewhat fascinating in terms of what he is thinking about to make Vermont more affordable. One of the things that he talks about is repeal community rating for health insurance and allow business and individuals to shop for health insurance in the national market. He also says enact community rating for automobile insurance. He says eliminate the annual automobile inspection requirement. He also says end the practice of license suspensions for young people with minor offenses not related to driving. You know, some of these I may agree with or may not agree with, but, you know, at least Scott McKay is getting some ideas out there in order to how to make Vermont more affordable for young people. If you have any suggestions, give us a call. We're going to go through a stack of material this morning, both in the front end of the hour as we wait for our caller to call in, or at the back of the hour as we I've reserved 30 minutes for you to call in to talk about anything, that you want. Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. That's Scott McKay, Ideas to Make Vermont More Affordable for Young People. And, you know, give him credit. The throwing ideas out is what we need here. You know, the repeal community rating for health insurance, enact community rating for automobile insurance, eliminate the annual inspection requirements for automobiles, and end the practice of license suspension for young people with minor offenses not related to driving. You know, like I said, not all those I agree with, not all, you know, some of them I disagree with, but you know what? At least somebody is putting some ideas on the table, and I think that is important. One of the things also I sort of want to talk about is something that lit up the phone lines yesterday, and I couldn't get to it in turn because we had so many guests on. It was what I was talking about with the VPR poll, and I guess you could say that what I was, the conclusion what I was saying is on the governor's race in that poll, don't jump to conclusions. And one of the reasons I say that is that there's a long way to go to November 8th. And just to remind people in terms of what was in that poll, 66% of those respondents who said that they have already made up their mind about who they would vote for the governor's race indicate they would support Scott. His nearest competitor is Matt Dunn, who trails by a huge amount, which is 15%. And if you sort of read the headlines out there, what you would take away from this poll is that Phil Scott has this election in the bag, that he would win handily right now if the election was held today. But there are a couple of things that you've got to think about when you're looking into this poll. By the way, with any poll, there are always things you need to look at. For example, when you look closer at this poll, 71% of Vermonters surveyed haven't decided or aren't sure who they'll support for governor. That is a significant number of undecided voters, and they're up for grabs for any candidate that wants to go get them. And you got to make your best case for their support, and it's yet to be seen who makes that case for those large number of voters. And you know, you may ask why there's so many undecided voters. Well, this time of year there usually is. I mean, statewide elections tend to really get going after the legislative session concludes, and that's, you know, usually at the end of April, middle of May, sometimes the end of May. And given the excitement surrounding the presidential election, you know what? It's no wonder that Vermonters really haven't paid attention to the statewide offices. But, and I will tell you this, they will. They will. And it also, something that's working in Scott's favor is the fact that he is lieutenant governor right now. And that is a higher profile than other candidates. So name recognition probably is helping him at this moment. But I'm going to tell you, that changes overnight when opponents start advertising. They increase their earned media. Earned media means that you go around, you talk with newspapers, you hold press conferences, those sort of things. That is going to change overnight when candidates start advertising, increase their earned media presence, and they start distributing campaign material, and they start going after one another. In a small state like Vermont, it doesn't take much to boost your name recognition, and many people can do that fairly easy. Of course, all of this takes money, the advertising, you know, not the earned media per se, but getting around to the earned media takes money. The advertising takes enormous amounts of money. A lot of candidates will be on TV, and that takes a lot of money. And, of course, the campaign material, the direct mails. And many of you have gotten direct mail from Hillary Clinton's campaign, for example, over the last few days. That all takes money. But if you look at the candidates, let's take Scott's primary opponent, for example, Bruce Lissman. He has plenty of money, and the expectation is that he'll use it. I think he's worth, with all of his assets, about $50 million. In the past, Matt Dunn has been a prolific fundraiser. He's been able to raise significant amounts of money. And although Sue Minter has yet to sort of proven herself as a successful fundraiser, she certainly can raise enough to compete. I'm fairly confident of that. Suffice to say, you know, look, in my opinion, all the candidates will have financial resources. All the candidates will be able to boost their name recognition. Where Scott has a lead right now in that, that probably will dissipate as time goes on. In terms of lead, in terms of the name recognition. The other thing that Scott has to contend with, that if he is the nominee, if he is the Republican nominee, the thing that he has to contend with is who is at the top of the Republican ticket. And right now, if you look at the VPR poll that we are quoting, where Scott is has 66% favorability, or 66% of those respondents who said they have already made up their mind would vote for him as governor. If you look at that same VPR poll, Donald Trump is leading other Republican candidates in Vermont's presidential primary. That's coming up next week on Town Meeting Day, or what is nationally known as Super Tuesday. And who is at the top of the ticket will be problematic for a Republican running in Vermont. The presidential race always has a bearing on the race for governor here in Vermont. And although Scott has indicated that he doesn't support Donald Trump, or he doesn't support U.S. Senator Ted Cruz, nonetheless, either of those names at the top of the ticket will be a hurdle that he must overcome. Because most, and this has been proven with Governor Douglas and others as well, most Vermonters reject this notion that that local Republican candidates are exactly like their national party leaders. In fact, many campaigns ago, it was Peter Clavel that tried to tie Governor Douglas to George Bush. It never worked, because Vermonters know their candidates. They know that they can't be tied to the national candidates, the national leaders, Republican leaders out there. So they do make a difference. If you remember Governor Douglas, he won when there was an unpopular George Bush in 2004. He won when there was a very popular actually in this state, Barack Obama in 2008. So they do this disconnect between national politics and local politics. But Scott is going to have to repeatedly remind voters of that distinction. The other thing that's probably more of a challenge for him, if a scenario comes to be, and that it would be Trump or Cruz at the top of the Republican ticket, with the possibility of Bernie Sanders as the Democratic nominee, that would be perhaps a greater challenge than what Douglas faced in 2004, or what he faced in 2008, because what that means is that there will be a huge turnout. This would mean a flood of voters coming to the polls that will be more inclined to vote for Democrats. And of course, you know, I just don't want to harp on this VPR poll and talk about Scott, but the Democrats have challenges too. I mean, this poll indicates that 9% of Vermonters support Hillary Clinton over Sanders. If she is the Democratic nominee, there's going to be less enthusiasm for her candidacy in Vermont than if Sanders were the nominee. And this is what's got to worry Democrats is that disappointed Sanders voters, many of whom don't like Clinton, may simply stay home in protest instead of voting for Clinton. In addition, Democrats running for governor will have to contend with this fact, a lack of enthusiasm for the current administration. The VPR poll indicated more Vermonters disapprove of the job Governor Peter Shumlin is doing than approve of his job performance. And this, you know, it's fascinating to watch the Democratic candidates out there, because Dunn has been really nuanced and cautious about his defense of the administration at public forums. Minter, on the other hand, is, you know, it was part of the administration, is an ally of Peter Shumlin, and actually has been unabashed in her defense of the administration at public forums. So it's really interesting what will happen, because it will be very problematic for any Democratic candidate if a majority of Vermonters coalesce around this notion that a vote for a Democrat will be a continuation of the policies and positions of the current administration. That's going to be a problem for them in this upcoming election. But the whole thrust of this, the whole thrust of what I've been just talking about, is that the governor's race is just getting started. And it's likely, although, you know, I think Phil Scott has to feel pretty good with the numbers that he's seeing so far, it's likely, though, the lieutenant governor will find himself in a tighter race fairly soon. So it's probably best not to jump to conclusions regarding the results of this newest poll. And it brings us back to where I started with the VPR poll. It's probably best not to jump to conclusions. Coming up, we'll speak with Senator Peg Flory. She is the chair of the Senate Institutions Committee, and we'll talk about things that are happening in that committee, as well as her support of Governor John Kasich. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. This is Mike Smith. Our next guest loves that music, Tom. Thanks for the bumper. State Senator Peg Flory, who's the chair of the Senate Institutions Committee. We're going to talk about happenings in the Senate Institutions Committee. That is the committee that does a lot of the capital projects here in the state. We're also going to talk about presidential politics, because Senator Flory is supporting Governor John Kasich, and he is let's start with that. Let's get the national politics out of the way. Why do you support Governor Kasich?
I've been watching all of the candidates and a lot of the debates, talking with folks, and a couple of the candidates impressed me from the beginning. Carly Fiorino did, and Governor Kasich. Governor Kasich, I like his approach. He refuses to get into the screaming, shouting match. He's the adult on stage. He takes the Vermont approach. On the social issues, I'm not basing it on those. What I think our main difficulty in the U.S. is security, jobs, and the economy. Kasich has shown through his track record in Ohio that he knows how to balance a budget. Through his record in Washington, he knows how to balance a budget. He knows how to keep the spending under control and grow the jobs. He's dealt with security issues. I think he's a good, strong candidate. Because he's not a yeller and a screamer, maybe he hasn't been getting the attention that I wish he would be getting. And I'll tell you, I was really so happy. I was not able to go last week when he was in Colchester because I had a funeral to go to. But we got the news that he wanted to come to Rutland County. So he's going to be doing a town hall meeting at Castleton this coming Monday at 11:30. So I'm really, really pleased that he's coming there.
What would you say to the, if the VPR, I spent 20 minutes on the VPR poll and we were talking about the governor's race, but in the presidential race, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I'm in the ballpark. 32% support Trump, 10% support the governor, Kasich. What would you say to those Trump supporters to try to sway them to the governor?
Listen to Governor Kasich. Governor Kasich can win in a general election. He doesn't offend people. When folks listen to him, and it's got to be so hard because he is understated. And it was funny, and he'd probably be really upset with me, but when I listened to Governor Kasich for the first time, my first thought was the understated manner of Jim Douglas, and I liked it. Mm-hmm. Let people listen. Let people come out and support it.
You know, he's been so understated. His debate performance last night was sort of off to the side compared to the three main contenders. Do you think that hurts him?
I think people want an adult as the next president. And getting into a yelling match, and I understand it. When you have one that is yelling and making accusations, it's... I had three sons. I can remember what it was like. But I hope it doesn't hurt him, because what he had to say last night was good.
Mm-hmm. You know, this seems to be the year of the outsider, and the governor from Ohio is an insider. I mean, he's a long-term congressman and now a governor. Why would he be attractive to voters? Because the voters seem to want an outsider, whether it's Bernie Sanders or whether it's anybody else.
Well, I'd really have a rough time saying Bernie Sanders is an outsider. I mean, he's been involved. I mean, that's been his job all his adult life.
I guess I meant outsider of the establishment. You're absolutely right.
Okay. Well, the governor has had a mixed crowd that he's worked with. He hasn't been a quote Washington insider. That hasn't been his only role. He's shown that he's been able to go manage state issues, manage national issues. I don't regard him as a political insider. And it's funny, summer neighbor of mine, we were talking this summer, he lives in Ohio the rest of the year. And Governor Kasich had just announced, and I really didn't know much about him. And he started talking with me about him. He and his wife were both discussing it, what he had done that was positive in Ohio. Mm-hmm. And yeah, Ohio's going to be a big state in this upcoming nomination.
And election. It always
and
is.
And election.
It's the pivotal state in the election.
Absolutely. And I have no doubt Governor Kasich is going to do really well. You talk polls, I think he was polling 63% popularity in Ohio.
But he's still behind Donald Trump in Ohio. But
Well, it depends on which poll you listen to.
We're speaking with State Senator Peg Florian. She's the chair of the Senate Institutions Committee. Want to sort of turn our subject now to state issues, not national politics. If you want to join our conversation, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. A little rambunctious conversation going on in the background.
It is. You said state politics.
Let me ask you this, Senator. What does the Senate Institution Committee do?
institutions is responsible for capital funding, bonded money, of essentially what all of the lands and buildings that the state owns or leases, doing the repairs to them, all of that.
Yeah. We have... Don't stop, because we have voices in our ears here. But on occasion, Tom will be talking to me in the studio, so that's what you'll hear in the background. With the Institution Committee, how do you set priorities?
Well, the way it works is there's been a little bit of a difference in the last few years. We now set a two-year budget. It used to be a one-year budget. Last year, we came up with the two-year budget. This year, we're dealing with only any changes in that second year that we might want to make. We receive from the governor a budget, a proposed budget, what he would like to see for the capital bill. We go over it. We try to set some priorities. I've chaired it. This is my fourth year chairing institutions. We have been really focused on Irene recovery for the most part, because that just took an enormous amount of our bonded money to be able to recover from Irene. But there are a variety of other things we deal with. We also hand out grants, not a whole lot, but grants to the agricultural fairs, to historic preservation, the old barn grants for restoration of those, money for some colleges. But the vast majority is for buildings, bricks and mortar, and land.
We're speaking with Senator Peg Flory, who's the chair of the Senate Institutions Committee. If you wish to join our conversation, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Rich in Huntington. Rich, you're on open mic.
Good morning, Mike. Good morning, Senator Flory. I know, Mike, you like to analyze trends in politics and see what the people are thinking and ferret out the reasons for the way polls are going. The last few days, there's been some recent endorsements by our local Republicans, as few as they are, in Vermont, for Kasich and Rubio. And I get the sense that these are not genuine people coming forward on their own. I get the feeling that there's probably a little bit of pressure from the insider Republican network on the national level. Maybe this is going on in other states. If it's going on in Vermont, it's probably going on in other states, to push local Republicans to promote these more insider, and so we can kind of push out the Cruz and the Trump element. Any admission to something like that, Senator Florio?
I'm happy to take that answer or that question. No, it was actually quite surprising. I was approached by a constituent who had known where my feelings were a few months ago. She knew I was torn between a few candidates, and she came and talked to me and asked who I was supporting. And I said, right now, Carly Fiorino had dropped out. I said, Kasich is the one on top of my score sheet. And she said, have you done anything about it? And I said, what do you mean? We're not voting yet. And she said, well, why don't you reach out to them? And I did. So they didn't reach out to me. I reached out to them.
Rich, I do think this is you pose a really good question. And I don't want to take a lot of the senator's time here, but one of the things that I think some of these Republicans are looking at is they have to run for re-election. in November, and who is at the top of the ticket makes a huge difference, especially, as I just said in the first part of the program, in the governor's race. So it probably is normal, out of self-survival, that they're looking at a candidate that they think they will help them, not hurt them, in a general election. I think most feel that Trump and Cruz in this state will hurt them, and so they're starting to, and remember, there's a primary coming up on Tuesday, so they're going to be looking at somebody to endorse pretty fast to try to persuade Vermonters to vote for somebody that may help them in the general election. Let's get back.
Let me just add one thing. I mean, I stopped when this friend said, why don't you reach out? And so I did. I just got on email and said, you know, I'm interested in supporting, wish I could have been there. But I look at it and think, it's not going to make any difference to most people who I support. Having my name on something, that doesn't mean anything. Now, talking with friends, talking with constituents, that's great, but there isn't going to be any candidate that wins on the Vermont primary just because one Republican or another endorsed them.
Let's get back to the Capitol bill. It's the big money bill. You said you're doing sort of the adjustments. This is the year of adjustments. You pass it in 1 year. It's a two-year bill. You do the adjustments. What are the big ticket items in there?
Well, one of the problems we had last year in the bill, part of it was because we didn't have a lot of general fund money. We were running at a deficit. Normally, the capital bill, because it's bonded money, is supposed to be items that have a life expectancy of 20 years, mm-hmm. bricks and mortar, for the large majority. If you're going to be able to sell the bonds, they group it, but at least 92% of your entire budget is supposed to be 20-year capital money. Last year, we ended up getting a proposal for four different IT projects that were going to take up about 35% of the budget.
And this includes the human services IT project, which
integrated eligibility,
which is about $400 million.
Well, that's not what it came in at. On our budget sheet, it looked at, I think it was $32 million. Well, I see you looking askance. Well, when they came in, we asked them. I asked them. I said, we're used to dealing with bricks and mortar, so you got to answer a few basic questions. Why do you need it? What's it supposed to do? What's the total purchase cost? What's the annual operating cost? What's the life expectancy? And how are you going to measure success? And they couldn't answer that. In fact, at one point, they told us they could explain it, but we wouldn't understand it.
How'd that make you feel?
That didn't go over really well. One of the integrated eligibility, when we started digging into the total purchase costs, it was over $300 million. And then when we looked at the annual operating cost, it was going to be, depending on who you talk to, somewhere between $18 million and $30 million per year operating costs. And, I mean, I will admit we got a little irreverent asking how many boxes of number two pencils that might buy, because that just seemed a really expensive piece. So there were a few IT projects that they were able to come back to us with the answers, and we funded those. One, Jimmy Reardon, had come to us with the financial management system that was, I think, a total of $6.8 million over 2 years. Judiciary came to us with case management. to try to be more efficient in the way the courts are managed. And so we did fund those with certain parameters, which they've met. The others, though, we said, nope. We'll put some of those decisions off till next year, being this year. But you got to come back and answer the questions. In addition, we appointed a independent IT review team committee that Mike Sherling chaired to look at the way we're doing IT projects. We also had a person hired for joint fiscal for the legislature to do an independent evaluation of all IT projects. We've gotten the results from that committee, from our independent analyst. And by the way, all of them said if someone can't answer those six simple questions, they're not ready to do IT. The integrated eligibility now has been, there's been a halt put on it. We were supposed to get an update yesterday on where they're hoping their next step will be, but as I went down to committee after doing the marijuana bill on the floor, got down to committee,
which we'll get to in a minute.
We'll get to in a minute. Got down to committee, and there was a note that they would not be coming in because they didn't have it ready yet. So we'll do that next week or the week after.
We're speaking with State Senator Peg Flory. She's a Republican from Rutland. She's the chair of the Senate Institutions Committee. If you wish to join the conversation, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Bill in Barry. Bill, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. Good morning, Peg. I'm so glad I hear what you said about Governor Kasich. I haven't quite decided who I'm going to vote for. There's only two or three that I would even vote for. We are definitely going to vote, and you're sort of aiming me towards Governor Kasich, because you know what you're going to get. You might call him an insider, but one thing you got to say, he has a record, and we know what his record is. It's a good record, and if I was going to hire somebody, and he was one of the choices, I'd want to hire him because I know what he's done. He's done very well. And as you said, he doesn't throw mud when he's that kid. But here's what I'm saying. At least two or three of the other candidates, you don't know what you're going to get because they haven't got a record. Now, they may call themselves outsiders, and let's vote for them because they're outsiders. But you don't really know what you're going to get. And I'll let you make a comment about that.
I thank you, and I like listening to your views, but I'm tell you, I'm going to try to model myself after Governor Kasich. I'm not going to mudsling on any other candidate, although I agree that he is the one with a proven record, and he's the one I'm supporting.
In a moment, we'll be back with Senator Peg Flory, Republican senator from Rutland County. She is the chair of the Senate Institutions Committee. Welcome your calls. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. This is Mike Smith. We're talking with State Senator Peg Flory, who is the chair of the Senate Institutions Committee, and I left a call hanging out there. That's Fred. Fred, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Oh, hi. Hey, well, I got a question. I'm sort of a security voter, and my question is, I have three documents that prove my identity, a U.S. passport and a passport card and a Vermont driver's license. And of those three documents, the Vermont driver's license puts me in an insecure way because it has my residential address on it. I can't think of any logical reason why I have to have my address or my driver's license. Can you think of a logical reason why I have to have my driver's license?
Fred, does it worry you because for years, I mean, I've grown up with the address, and I suspect, Fred, if I knew your last name, I'd be able to get your address on the internet, by the way. Is there a reason you're concerned about your address being on the driver's license?
Yeah, because you don't know me. You wouldn't know me, right? You wouldn't know me. If I drop my driver's license in a public place, right, and someone picks it up, he looks at it and he says, oh, it's Fred. But I don't know Fred, and I know where his address is, and I know what he looks like. And so that's a major, major risk. New Hampshire doesn't require you to put your address on your driver's license. And the two best documents you can get for identification are federal government ones, and they don't require an address. There's no need for it.
Let me do this, Fred. Let me get somebody on, because I don't have an answer for you. I'm sure the senator doesn't have an answer for you. Let me get somebody from DEV that has an answer. Maybe it has to do, if there's a bad accident, they can be able to identify. I have no idea, but let me try to find somebody for you that can answer that question, because I think both of us are a little stumped in terms of what's on there. Thank you for your phone call. Senator, you know, when we're talking about IT, most people will jump right to Vermont Health Connect because it's an IT project that has had its problems, to say the least. Is the Senate Institutions Committee involved in Vermont Health Connect?
Peripherally involved, anyway. One of the difficulties we had, and it's one of the reasons we last year ended up getting someone for joint fiscal to work for the legislature on just IT, is there has been no specific committee in the legislature that oversees IT projects. So it sort of ran on the edge of all sorts of different committees. There was no specific committee charged with doing Vermont Health Connect. However, when last year the governor put into the proposed budget all sorts of other IT projects, we were well aware of the problems with Vermont Health Connect. So we decided if the other IT were in our gamut, we were going to look at all of it. So we did hear from the Gardner Group, which was the group that was supposed to be the independent advisor to Vermont Health Connect from the outset. And I mean, frankly, we were quite surprised to find out they had warned months before that, as designed, it couldn't work. Mm-hmm. Don't do it. The administration proceeded to go ahead and do it. They were advised numerous other times after that, hey, what you're trying to do isn't going to work the way you want it to work. You got to make some changes. And changes were not made. So we are still looking at that, trying to frankly find out how much state money has been spent and how much federal. Because I don't know about you, Mike, but I really resent when someone tells me, oh, don't worry, that wasn't state money, that's federal money. That's my left pocket instead of my right pocket. It's still my tax dollar. I still want to spend it wisely.
From what I'm reading from news reports, the Gardner Group said stop. Just stop
they
right now.
They absolutely said stop and get an independent analysis as where you can go from here. Look at the federal exchange. Look at joining some of the other exchanges. Don't do any more till you find out what you did wrong and where you can go from here.
And what's your involvement? Will that have to be a sort of a legislative effort to say, stop, let's do an independent assessment? Or does that come from the administration, or does it come from both? Would something like that go into the capital bill?
It could. Certainly, the one thing that has to go into one of the bills despite how much the administration might want to do something, if we don't give them the money to do it, they've got a problem. Unless we find, which we found out with the integrated eligibility, we told them last year, stop. Once we got out of session, we were quite surprised to find they were putting out RFPs. We said, we didn't give you the money. Oh, we got some in our kitty. Well, we didn't know there was a kitty. So we've asked for a breakdown and how much they've spent, because last year the House recaptured some of the money in their capital bill, sent it over to us, and surprise, surprise, in the 1 week it took, they had spent, I think it was $5.5 million that had been recaptured. They quickly spent it.
Let's move on to other stuff that's sort of outside the purview of Institutions Committee. What was your vote on the marijuana bill, and why?
I voted no each time. I think it's bad policy. I serve in transportation in the morning, and we had talked with the public safety folks in both Washington and in Colorado, received the statistics on the increased driving impaired marijuana related that they'd had in those, the increased fatalities marijuana related that they had in those two states. One of the huge difficulties is, unlike alcohol, where there's a fairly easy way to measure it, there is no easy, recognizable, legally defensible way to set a intoxicated level for marijuana. And I just want to point out one thing. I don't buy the prohibition didn't work comparison to alcohol argument. There's a huge, huge difference between alcohol and marijuana. Alcohol, if you're going to get drunk, you need to drink it. Marijuana, you don't need to imbibe it. You need to, at times, be in the same room inhale it.
We've got about 30 seconds. Just yes or no, premium tax, yes or no? The premium tax?
No.
Okay. Carbon tax?
No.
Gun control?
Absolutely not.
What is the, when you go back today to the Institutions Committee, what are you going to be looking at?
Today we're dealing with a very mundane issue, but last year Duxbury wanted to do a land swap with the state. We're dealing with some of that.
Thank you, Senator Peg Flory from Rutland County. She is the chair of the Senate Institutions Committee. Thank you for being on Open Mic.
Thank you, Mike.
Coming up, I'll check in with our friends at Talk Media News, and then a discussion with Senator Dick Mazza. It seems like the governor's office has thrown him under the bus. We'll ask why. This is Open Mic on WDEV Radio News, AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury, Vermont, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and 101.9 FM from Island Pond. And of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Our next segment is our daily check-in with Talk Media News. And on the line today is Victoria Jones. Victoria, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Hey, you know, it was quite a match last night. It was interesting to watch.
Yeah. Interesting is an understatement. It was a bit of a brawl, actually. It was wild. It wasn't a political debate. It was wrestling.
That's why I said it was an interesting match last night. It definitely, Marco Rubio engaged Donald Trump last night, and probably those two were the main event. You had Cruz trying to get in on occasion. You had poor Ben Carson saying, you know, please insult me or whatever he said so that he could get into the debate. And I was surprised by Governor Kasich, who didn't seem to engage. It sort of is with his mantra of staying above the fray, but it doesn't help him, does it?
No, it doesn't help him because he's running this very positive campaign. And more power to him, because ultimately history will write that down, that he stayed positive. And I think in the world of karma, and I do think that counts in the universe, it's a good thing. But this year, which is a year of hate and fear in the Republican Party, it's not helping him. But there were five men on that debate stage, and you wouldn't have known it. And as you say, you know, Ben Carson asking to be attacked. How weird is that? But you know what went viral last night was when Carson said that in order to evaluate a Supreme Court nominee, I would look at what a person's life has been, the fruit salad of their life. Fruit salad is what went viral last night.
Yeah, it's amazing to me. But getting back to the main event, Rubio definitely engaged Trump. He started out by really going after Trump on hiring illegal immigrants, and then sort of Trump came back at him, and then, you know, they talked about, you know, the $1 million in judgment that he did. You know, Trump hit Cruz with, you know, nobody likes you in the Senate. You know, Rubio takes Trump to school mainly over Trump University, that it's a fake school, and then sort of hit him hard with the line that if it wasn't for your daddy giving you $1 million or $2 million, you know, you'd be selling watches on the streets of Manhattan. How does this all come across to the viewers, in your view?
Well, I think it depends which viewers. I mean, I think if you're a Trump follower, like a sort of fan cult follower, they literally don't care what comes out of his mouth. It could be snakes, you know, or spiders. They don't care what he says because they're looking for a strong man. They're looking for Ceausescu. They're looking for Mussolini. They're looking for a strong man who is going to lead them into making America great again. And when is somebody going to challenge the Trump on whether America is great now? Nobody in the Republican Party is going to challenge him on that, but Hillary Clinton will, and that's going to be an interesting conversation. So they want someone to make America great again, and so they believe Trump's going to do that, and they don't care what he has to do to do it or what he has to say to do it. So they don't care what he says. But I do think that some independent Republican-leaning independents and some moderate Republicans who might have been watching, and not everyone was watching, who might have been watching, and who were, and there were quite a lot of reports in the last couple of days of people saying, Republicans saying, well, if he's the nominee, of course I'll have to vote for him. I don't want to vote for him. I'll have to vote for him. I'll hold my nose. I'll have to vote for him. Even Senator Lindsey Graham saying, yeah, I bought a ticket on the Titanic, you know, but also calling him a nut job and saying Hillary Clinton's going to win. These people are now looking at it and saying, maybe I don't have to slash my wrists after I go into the booth and vote. Maybe there is an alternative. So I think some of these people are seeing a little bit of hope.
We saw the feisty contest last night, and particularly going after Trump. That has been an unusual event in previous debates. Is it too late? Does Trump have a clear path to the nomination?
Oh, he has a clear path to the nomination, most definitely. It's interesting that just in the last few days, a senior member of the Rubio campaign made a presentation to about 200 people, 200 serious supporters of Rubio in New York, saying that, you know, they're looking for a brokered convention and with a PowerPoint presentation, and that this is how they think he can get the nomination. Well, that's all dependent on assuming that Trump doesn't have a majority of the delegates going into the convention. So that's a pretty big bet.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn to the Democrats. Saturday is the South Carolina primary. You have Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton is expected to win big. What would be what can Senator Sanders expect out of there?
I don't think that Senator Sanders can expect a very good result out of South Carolina, and he hasn't been there all that much this week. He has had a few events there. He has not written it off completely, and he's been very vocal, actually, anytime that anybody in the media has confronted him about that, as they have, to say that he hasn't written it off. He has been campaigning there. But it's been notable that he's campaigned in a lot of other states this week, whereas Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton, because she's getting two for the price of one, have campaigned heavily in South Carolina, which has a big African-American population, and she's been campaigning, hitting all those themes. But Bernie Sanders is looking forward to Super Tuesday, and he's been campaigning in a lot of Great Lakes states where he's hoping to do well. And that's really where he's focused right now, I think.
One last thing here, Victoria, where I have you on the line. The rumor around Washington the last few days was that President Obama was looking closely at Governor Sandoval in Nevada. The governor has said, whoa, wait, I'm not interested. Is that surprising or not surprising in the D.C. area?
I don't think it's surprising. I think it was surprising that he was looking at him, because he doesn't have enormous jurisprudence chops, but it was an interesting 1.5 day story, and I don't think it's surprising that he's not interesting. I mean, I know it's the lambing season, but I don't think he wanted to be a sacrificial lamb.
Do you think it was leaks just to put the Republicans in a spot here, that the president was looking at a Republican? And because the Republicans have said no hearings, no nomination.
I think stranger things have happened.
Well, listen, Victoria, have a great weekend, and it's great to talk to you again.
You too. I'll talk to you next week.
Okay, thank you. That's Victoria Jones from Talk Media News. We check in with them every day at this time. Up next, Senator Dick Mazza, Democrat from Colchester. We'll talk to him about what the governor's office is saying about him. Up next on Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. I have the pleasure of welcoming to the Open Mic show Senator Dick Mazza. He's a Democrat from Colchester. Senator, how long have you been a Democrat?
Well, Mike, I started the Democratic Party. I worked on Phil Hoff's first campaign back in the 60s. And so I was very active, and that's why I started my politics with my dad. My dad was in the politics many years, and so my first campaign was working for Phil Hoff. We had a school bus, and we painted it all up. We call it the Hoffway Express.
Well, let's talk about a school bus, because somebody ran a bus over you yesterday, and that is the governor's office. And the reason I asked how long you've been a Democrat, because the governor's spokesman, Scott Coryell, who probably hasn't been alive as long as you've been a Democrat, said that you're a Republican, basically. How do you respond?
Well, you know, I was a little disappointed in that call yesterday. I think that's very unfortunate. I don't think he's got his facts straight. If he's upset over the issue of divestments, I stand by what I said, and I believe that if he wants to criticize me for not supporting the governor on this issue, it's very unfortunate.
Yeah, I've never. Where's the loyalty in politics, or has there ever been loyalty in politics?
You know, I think we have to decide. We make our decisions based on the facts, and sometimes we'll disagree. And it's very unfortunate that we get criticized for that. But I've always been able to base my decisions on what my constituents ask me, and it's like I said, this is an issue that he certainly is not accurate on this one, and I think it's unfortunate. But having said that, I'm disappointed on his reaction.
You know, one of the things, and I guess I learned it when I was in the service and it was in SEAL Team, was you never leave your swim buddy. It meant that you stay loyal to the people that have been loyal to you. You've been an ally of Governor Shumlin, and yet this sort of thing happens. How does that make you feel?
Yeah, you know, I felt kind of bad last night about it when I read it. I guess there's very few people have been as loyal as I have to the governor through all the years. We were together when he was pro tem of the Senate. And let me tell you, there was a lot of issues that I support him on, and it's very saddening to think that an issue such as this, even a couple of weeks ago when he would not support small businesses on exemption for paid sick leave, and you know, those are issues that, you know, we all have our opinions on, and there's nothing wrong with that, and so. To pick apart, you know, just because you didn't support him on an issue like divestment, which certainly he's way wrong on this one, to say that I'm not a Democrat, I just don't understand where that reasoning came from.
Let's turn. Why I've got you here. I've got to start. You're chair of the Transportation Committee. Got to ask you a couple of questions about issues that are going on in the Transportation Committee. What are you seeing in the transportation this year that's going to come out of that transportation bill?
Well, we're very healthy this year, and I think we've got a good program. As you know, the federal government has proposed a new bill, and we will be receiving more money than ever. Well, I think another $10 million extra. So, you know, we've got about a $618 million budget. It's up about, you know, $15-18 million from last year. And so I think you're going to see a very aggressive program, whether it's paving, bridge repairs, maintenance in general. So, you know, we're very fortunate to get a good bill, along with, although gasoline, you know, is declining revenues. But all in all, I think we're probably in the best shape we've been in for many years. So you'll see a lot of progress this year in our transportation infrastructure.
No carbon tax in the transportation.
No carbon tax. You know, I don't know where that's coming from. You know, I understand gasoline is a low price, and that's the good news. People are traveling in Vermont because of necessity, and it's helping. And the last thing we need is a 90-cent a gallon increase in a carbon tax, which, as I understand it, does not go back to the roads.
Now, what's interesting is that the Senate had a vote in the last few days on marijuana. It passed the Senate. But some of the testimony that you took in transportation was on the ability to deal with impairment. How do you spot impairment in somebody that has been smoking marijuana and driving a vehicle? What did you learn in those hearings?
Well, that's interesting, because the conversation we had with Washington and Colorado, both, we took quite a bit of testimony. And there are still no perfect formulas out there that can detect it. And that's what troubles me more than anything, because law enforcement throughout Vermont, 99% of them, whether it's the sheriffs or whether it's the local police departments, whether it's the state police, testified that we don't have the mechanism in place. And yet that was kind of ignored in the issue, because to me, that's the part of the bill that we focus on, is the safety part. Unless something happens within the next 2 years that can detect it, we got more people to train for detection. So it's not ready for prime time, and that's the disappointing part of it. Not that it's not going to happen, but I just feel that we're rushing into something, not knowing a lot of the issues. In fact, Colorado is still working their way through it, as well as Washington. One thing they told us loud and clear is, please wait a couple of years and find out more of our mistakes before you go into this issue, so you can correct them before you go into it, because it's very difficult to correct them after.
Of course, the Senate just passed just last week was the paid sick leave bill, I believe it was.
That's correct.
One of the things that a lot of people were trying to do was get a small business exemption in there from anywhere from 2 to 5 employees. There was various amendments of what that number would be.
Right.
You supported that those efforts.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. We talk about helping small businesses. That's one of the things we hear over and over again. Well, how do you help small business? Well, you had the opportunity to do, you know, 75%. And let 25% of it help a small business who has 2 employees or 3 employees. I think we're outside of California, one of these states that did not have an exemption for small businesses. And so, you know, when I heard the governor say, well, it's $400 or $500 per employee, that's nothing. It is something. It's very serious when you got four employees or five employees. It's another $2,000-$3,000 a year, and I just don't think we're being business friendly when we start doing things like that. There could have been an exemption, and it wouldn't have hurt the big picture, but it would have showed that we do care about small businesses.
One of the things that we've talked about in the past, or two things that we've talked about, bicycle safety and salt brine. Obviously, we're probably not using a lot of salt brine.
Well, there's more bicycles on the road this winter, and there's less salt brine. In fact, yesterday I talked to the maintenance people at AOT, and I think salt usage is down about a half of where we were a year ago at this time. Now, that could change in the next few weeks, but we are very, very fortunate this year, so we should have some extra money in maintenance.
Was there a change in how we apply salt brine?
Yes.
Brine? Can you explain?
Yes, we... There was a lot of a sticky substance in the past, like a molasses substance, that that stuck to the vehicle more so than today. Today, that's being diluted down for, there's very little sticky substance, and it's more of a water-based, and so it won't stick to the vehicles. So we are addressing that concern. We listen loud and clear that we had to make some changes, and I'm pretty comfortable now that you won't see the erosion that you have in the past.
One of the things that we talked about and sort of is a favorite subject of mine, through tragedy at least, was bicyclists who are being killed on the roads. As you look at the transportation bill, is there an effort to make sure that there's room for both vehicles and bicycles on the road?
I can say anywhere we move in transportation, every project we look at, is how can we make it accessible for bikes? We try to widen our shoulders when we repave. We try to clean the shoulders for biking. We have put an all-out effort in bike paths and bike lanes. I'm very pleased this year. There's more money in the budget for bikes, bike lanes, and I think we're making a tremendous amount of progress. We're working with different groups now where we can, different parts of the state that we can focus on, that there had more bike traffic than other parts, but we're doing all we can.
Let's go to the phone lines, and let's go to Sam in Williston. Sam, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning. How you doing?
Great, thank you.
Good morning.
The three items you covered there, the detection of marijuana, I think you could go with looking for how many wrappers, Girl Scout cookie wrappers are on the seat and floor of the car. Maybe a telltale sign. The Girl Scouts figured out where to set up shop and sell it to people that are smoking. And then as far as the Senate hiring somebody to look into the effect of the new paid leave scenario, I'd say you don't need to spend that money. Just count how many businesses go out of business next year due to it. And why aren't we registering bikes and having bikes paid? Help pay for these paths. Go from there.
Well, let's start with the last one first, and then I'll weigh in on the first one. But the first one was, you know, why don't we just look for the telltale signs, which is, you know, snacks, and that would tell you if they're smoking marijuana. But let's I think Sam's being a little bit facetious. So let's go with the last one. Is there any effort to register bikes?
You know, Mike, that's come up on a yearly basis since I've been here, I believe, and it's quite you know, there's an interesting discussion. Number one, how much could you charge a bike? You'd have to make it enough that you could, you know, at least cover the cost of implementing it. And when you start talking about registering bikes, so was it $25 or $50? Excuse me. Then you're taking away. We encourage people to get out and ride bikes. We encourage them for exercise. So there's a thin line here. How do you charge a youngster who wants to ride a bike $25, $50? And I don't think you could do it less than $25, $30 because the cost of administering such a thing. Then you'd have to have enforcement. So it adds up to a tremendous amount of money for what you'd receive in return.
We've been speaking with Senator Dick Mazza, who's a Democrat from Colchester. Actually, he's been a Democrat in Vermont before being a Democrat was cool. So, you know, he's been a Democrat for a long time, and we've talked about you know, the hit that the governor's office gave him in terms of being sort of discourteous to him, also, and not being as loyal as you would expect, and also other things as well dealing with transportation. Up next, we're going to take your phone calls on any issue that you want to talk about. I've got a stack of stuff here that I've got to that I want to get through, but you can divert the subject to other things. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. In this half hour, what time we've got left here, we're going to take your calls on anything that you want. I mean, I've got a pile of stuff here that I can go through, but one of the things that I want to do is we've been talking a lot of politics. If there's other things you want to talk about, please give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. It is the year of politics, but if there are other things, whether it's movies or town meeting or anything else that you wish to discuss, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Mike in Barrie. Mike, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. I think your listeners would be interested in hearing, to the extent possible, of your experience as a Navy SEAL. I know that covers a lot of ground, but perhaps you can tell us something.
You know, Mike, I'm really reluctant to talk about my background because this show is about you and the callers and the guests. But let me give you sort of some of it, if I may. You know, one of the things, and I've said this many times on Open Mic, you know, many of the things that happened to me early in life were not good. I mean, it was my own fault. It's nobody else's fault. You know, I blamed everybody else. I blamed police, school teachers, my parents, you know, anybody that I could blame on my behavior. What happened after I went into the service and once I started SEAL team training turned my life around forever. And you know, I don't like to dwell on it, but at the same time, it is an important aspect of my life, and it sort of controls my life since those days. I mean, one of the things that, you know, I learned was that hard work, you know, when I was in high school, and you've heard me say this before, but when I was in high school, I thought luck played the only factor in whether you succeeded in life. If you were lucky, you succeeded. If you were unlucky, well, that's the way it goes. Luck passed you by, and that's you know, you're destined by luck. Boy, that's sort of a fatalistic sort of attitude, and not a good attitude, because you know, you're sort of relying that you're going to hit the lottery on that sort of thing. And by the way, you're relying on other people to make decisions for your life, and that's never a good thing. You need to take control of your own life, and that's one of the things that I learned sort of in SEAL team training, was you've got to take control of your own life and take control of your own situation, because if you don't, other people will. And the other thing was hard work. I mean, as I said, I thought luck was it, but no, it's hard work. It's working hard to an objective. It's wanting an objective and then working your tail, your butt off in order to get it. It's also perseverance, because you will have setbacks. And you know, when I was a kid, when I was a teenager, if you had a setback, well, you know, it didn't work out. You move on, you do something else, you know. But if you're striving for a goal, you're going to have setbacks, and perseverance is important. One of the things that I learned, at least in SEAL team training, was the aspect of honesty. Not only honesty with other people, which I wasn't honest in high school with other people. I wasn't honest with myself in high school, but honesty with yourself as well as with others, and that is important. And one of the things that I learned, I'll tell you a story about something that happened to me when I was deployed in SEAL team. One of the things that I had to do was to blow up a with explosives a jam in a river, and this river was in a foreign country, and the explosives that I was using were in a foreign language, and I didn't know how to interpret them or what the potency of the explosives were. So what I did was double the amount because I was unsure, because I was assuming that they were less potent than American explosives. And what I learned is never to assume. Never to assume. You know, and the reason I say that is because when I touched off that shot and that explosion went off, the logjam went way up in the air. It was only supposed to go like poof, and the logs were supposed to float down the river, but it sent all those logs, telephone-sized logs, up in the air, and that could have hurt people. And luckily it didn't, but what it taught me was never to assume. I hear more people talk about the fact that they go with their gut. Well, you know what? Your gut's going to be wrong most of the time if you don't have facts. And, you know, you can go with your gut if you don't have any facts, but go with the facts. Don't assume. How many times do we come in to a situation where we see a person and we assume that something about that person, whether it's the color of their skin, their ethnic orientation, you know, their sexual orientation. We assume about those people, and those assumptions lead to biases, and that's why I say never assume. One of the things that I learned a lot about in SEAL Team was how to work as a team, and I got to tell you, that is so important in life, of how to work as a team. Most people in SEAL Team won't say they're in SEAL Team. They will say, I'm in the teams, or that guy's in the teams. And the team concept is so important. And one of the things that I think, if you're going to be successful in life, you got to have partners, you got to have a team to be successful. And one of the things that lead to being successful is being flexible, because things change on a dime, by the way, in life, or whether you're in the military. You've really got to listen to people, because, you know, one thing of the team is that the input of the team is important, and you've got to be precise in how you communicate with people. Look, opinions count here, and you got to listen to them, and you got to be precise in what you return to them. One of the things is respect. You got to be respectful of people, and I've always tried, you know, in my life to be respectful of people. I know it's in politics, it's a blood sport, and you try to, you know, the one thing that bothers me, whether it's in politics or blood sport, is nowadays we seem to have to destroy people. And that is something that I think is wrong. You have to respect people. You don't have to get along. You don't have to like what they say, but you certainly have to respect people. The one thing that I learned also was you don't have all the answers when you're operating in a team. It's important to get those answers as a team. And loyalty is extremely important. That's why I was surprised by the governor's throwing Senator Mazza, you know, under the bus in terms of loyalty, because that senator has stood by the governor in various situations where it hasn't been easy to stand by him, and yet he threw him under the bus. And loyalty not only to those that work for you, but those that, you know, that you work for, I think is important. The last thing, and let me just, and I'm sorry to dwell on this to all of you, Mike, you shouldn't have got me started here, but one of the things that I learned, at least in training, and I think in life as well, is that one of the things that really destroys a team is when somebody tries to take credit for everything or whines about what other people are doing. And those people in SEAL Team training that either whined about the exercise or boasted about, you know, how good they were, those people weren't there very long, because it just showed that they didn't want to be part of a team. And as I mentioned, the team concept is very important. Mike, I hope I answered your call. I don't like to talk a lot about it. You know, this program's about you. It's about your calls, what's on your mind. And that's what we're trying to do today, what's on your mind in terms of issues. I got a stack of stuff. Mike, you got me sort of waylaid on a couple of things here. But I got a stack of stuff I want to get through. But I'm more interested in what's on your mind. Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. One of the things that we've been concentrating on is the debate last night and the Republicans here in Vermont. This week we've had several guests on that have been representing various campaigns. We didn't have one guest today. I don't know what happened with that guest in terms of Marco Rubio, senior strategist and advisor, didn't call in this morning, but you know, those things happen on live radio. But one of the things that we haven't looked at is the Democratic side. And certainly, you know, Senator Sanders, the expectation is that Senator Sanders will not, the expectation is that Senator Sanders will not do well in South Carolina this weekend, and it is a game of expectations. You know, he doesn't necessarily have to win South Carolina. If he does better than expectations, he still gains momentum. It's a weird blood sport, this game of politics, and it's all about expectations. But I'm interested in what's on your mind. Give me a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Fred in New Haven. Fred, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Yes, sir. Could I go back to the issue you were talking about with bicycles on the road?
Sure.
I should have called when he was on the air, and I think he ought to be proud of the fact that somebody said he was a Republican, but that's beside the point.
I don't think he feels that he's proud of it, but go ahead.
With this bicycle thing, in my life, everything I have ever done for recreation, hunting, fishing, trapping, boating, snowmobiling, everything, I've had to pay a fee to be on the road. We have an infrastructure in place. Why can't bicyclists, kayakers, and all those things buy a license similar to a hunting and fishing license so that they can run on the road? And a kid can ride on the road till, say, he's 14, 15 years old. Beyond that point, he can buy his license to ride on the road just like everybody else. You get a little sticker to stick on your bicycle. Anybody can look at it in the way of a game warden, a sheriff, or a cop, or any of any kind, and know that that guy or person is paying their way to ride their bicycle. And I think it's a simple solution.
Well, Fred, thank you for your phone call. I mean, that's an interesting interesting perspective, and many have shared your perspective out there. What do others think? Should we be paying for the right to use the roads on a bicycle? Maybe a fee, and as Senator Mazza had talked about, that fee would probably be between $35 and $50 because of the administration of that fee. Some money would have to come out of that. But certainly, what do you think we should do? Should people pay for the right to use our roads with a bicycle, on a bicycle? Now, Fred brings up a really good point. We would exempt kids up to a certain age, but after that age, you would have to pay a fee to be on the road on a bicycle. What's your opinion about what's your opinion about anything today? Could be a movie, could be town meeting. I have opened up the microphone for you today to give me your opinions. Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. In a moment, we'll return to your phone calls. You know, Fred from New Haven said we should charge for the right to use a bicycle on our roads. What's your opinion? Or anything else? Movies, town meeting. Be very interested in your opinions or comments about anything that may be on your mind. Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. This is Open Mic. Well, we're going a little mellow coming into the open mic show. This is open mic. I'm Mike Smith. What we're doing in this segment, we've got about 8 minutes to check in on you and try to figure out what's on your mind. What issues are important to you? And one of the things that we have been talking about are a wide ranging of issues, including Fred from New Haven, who wanted to talk about maybe we charge for the right to use bicycles on our highways and, you know, charging people to ride on our highways just like we do with a car or anything else. What's your opinion? If you have an opinion, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. But it doesn't have to be about that. It can be about anything today. The microphone's open for you to call in. Let's go to Fred in Montpelier. We have a lot of Freds today. Let's go to Fred in Montpelier. Fred, you're on open mic.
Thank you. I agree with the other Fred, but he mentioned in passing kayaks, and I'm a boater and fisher person, and kayaks just clog the ramps. They're nice people. I've talked to them, and I've been kayaking myself, but they should definitely be registered, because we, through our fishing licenses and trailer and boat registrations, pay for them, and usually we go to a fishing spot, and we can't even get near it because they're clogged with the kayak folks, who are nice enough when you talk to them, they move so you can back your trailer in. And I believe for a nominal rate, so they can include themselves in the ownership, like $10. $10 sticker would be good. And I believe New Hampshire does that. I believe they register anything that's floatable. So I think we should register the kayaks. Thank you.
Fred, thank you for your opinion. This is going in a different direction than I ever thought today, but it's good. That's what we have. That's why we open up our microphones and talk about various issues. We've had Fred in New Haven talk about registering bicycles and making people pay for a fee to use the highways. We've had Fred from Montpelier that talks about kayaks and maybe registering kayaks and making people pay for fees to use the waterways. Let's go to Kevin in Weybridge. Kevin, what say you?
Hi there, Mike. Thanks for taking the call. I wanted to talk about the marijuana issue as far as it affecting drivers. You know, sure. I'm of the opinion that driving while impaired is a serious thing. But I think it's a bit of a red herring. Hello?
Yeah, you're on.
Oh, I'm sorry.
There?
I think it's a bit of a red herring, all this undue concern about marijuana and driving. Because there's a lot of evidence that it just does not affect driving in any way similar to alcohol. In my own personal experiences, I'm 62 years old, and I'm a medical marijuana patient, and I drive every day. And any time, if they did a blood test, I would have a THC level in my blood that would, some people might think, could cause impairment. But it just doesn't affect the motor skills the way alcohol does. And
Kevin, I don't know where to go with this, but let me try to go with this. I can't
Please.
Believe that it doesn't impair you in some way. I mean, all studies suggest that marijuana will cause impairment, and getting behind a wheel.
I don't believe that's true, Mike. All studies. No, I'm sure that's not the case. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just. Isn't there a point, though? I guess what I'm asking, isn't there a point? Just like alcohol, you can have a beer and then you drive and it's not impairment. But isn't there a point where there is impairment with marijuana?
I believe there probably is. But I think you would have to smoke such stupid amounts of it. You know, and as far as comparing it to alcohol, you know, for years and years there's been the standard roadside sobriety test where you have to walk a line and touch your nose and all that stuff. And it's, you know, for the most part, I think that's a pretty effective way of judging impairment. But that's totally not effective with marijuana use, because the people pass the test, you know, almost all the time. And as a matter of fact, if you have a minute, if you look up the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration recently completed a huge study of, I'm reading from Car and Driver magazine as I'm speaking to you, a new study commissioned by them
had a 20-month study of 10,800 drivers, and the main takeaway for this was, it says, when factoring age, sex, and race, there was no significant increased risk of crash involvement due to marijuana use. Now, this is the government's own study. This is a huge study, and this just backs up what I'm saying. I think a lot of this, I think, if I'm not mistaken, they hired a lot of extra police as part of the new S-241 marijuana law.
Hey, Kevin, thank you for your call. I want to try to get everybody in here before we go off the air, for this program. Let's go to Greensboro. Greensboro, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hi, Mike. This is Lynette in Greensboro, Bend. You said the word movie, and I had to call. Michael Moore's new movie, Where to Invade Next, is the most incredible movie I have ever seen. A bunch of us went down to the Roxy in Burlington to see it this week. I can't recommend it highly enough.
What's it about, Lynette?
It's humorous, but it's about Michael Moore goes to invade 9 or 10 countries that are whose populations are similar to ours, being white mostly and things like that, and in Europe and Africa, you know, Portugal, Italy, France, Norway, Sweden, and Finland and Iceland, and he's going there to look for the good ideas they have to bring back to the United States. And they cover school lunches, the death penalty, drug laws, women's rights. I mean, it just covers everything. And to see the French kids having an hour for lunch and calling it a class and learning things from it, and then when he showed the kids on his cell phone what American kids were eating for lunch, they blanched. and I blanched, and I was almost in tears. And it's also about education.
Yeah, Lynette, I'm running out of time here, but it's Michael Moore's movie, right? Well, Lynette, thank you so much. She suggested Michael Moore's movie, What Country to Invade Next, I think it is the name. I didn't write it down. Hey, I got to thank all our guests today. Got to thank Senator Peg Flory for coming in and talking about the Senate Institutions Committee. Got to thank Senator Dick Mazza for coming in and talking about the governor throwing him under the bus. But I want to thank all of you. It's been a busy week with a lot of guests, and I thank all of you for your phone calls and for listening. I really appreciate it. This is Open Mic on WDEV Radio News, AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury, Vermont, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and 101.9 FM from Island Pond. And of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. We'll talk again on Tuesday. Have a great weekend, everyone.